Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!, our holiday special.
The first Thanksgiving story begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace.
Our history is the future. As the nation marks Thanksgiving, we speak to the Indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes on settler colonialism and continuing Indigenous resistance. Then to the prize-winning author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates about his new book, The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank and Israel.
The occupied territories are segregated. The Jews segregated. It's not, you know, hard to understand. There are different signs for where different people can go. There are different license plates forbidding different people from going different places. Now, what the authorities will tell you is that this is a security measure. But if you go back to the history of Jim Crow in this country, they would tell you the exact same thing.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this special broadcast, we begin the show with the Indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes. He's co-founder of the Indigenous resistance group, The Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. His books include Our History is the Future, which tells the history of Indigenous resistance over two centuries, offering a roadmap for collective liberation and a guide to fighting life-threatening climate change. Estes centers this history in the historic fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. I asked him to talk about the two Thanksgiving stories he writes about at the beginning of his book.
The first Thanksgiving story begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace. And then I begin with another story of a prayer march that we led in the Bismarck Mall in Bismarck, North Dakota, to kind of bring attention to the Standing Rock struggle during a Black Friday shopping event, which was met by police armed with AR-15s, who then began punching and kicking water protectors who were holding a prayer in the Bismarck Mall. And I thought it was a really kind of jarring sort of contrast between the past and the present, to say that while there are sort of differences between the massacre of Pequots in Massachusetts to the contemporary sort of fight against an oil pipeline, nonetheless, you know, Bismarck, North Dakota is a 90% white community that originally the Dakota Access Pipeline was supposed to go upriver from, but then was rerouted downriver to disproportionately affect the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And disproportionate is the language that the Army Corps of Engineers use, as if there's ever a proportionate risk to environmental issues and water contamination. So at this particular moment, there weren't any actions that were happening in the camps, and it was largely at a standstill. And I think at that Thanksgiving weekend, there was an un-Thanksgiving feast that was held in the camps, and it was actually the highest point of the camps themselves, in the sense that there were the most sort of water protectors had showed up. So I thought it was a good kind of contrast to show that this history, you know, is a continuing history of genocide, of settler colonialism, and basically the founding myths of this country.
Your book's last words are, we're challenged not just to imagine, but to demand the emancipation of Earth from capital. For the Earth to live, capitalism must die. Explain.
So that line is part of, you know, this longer section on liberation. And I think when we think about climate change, oftentimes the question of climate change really centers on market-driven solutions, such as, you know, green capitalism, and how do we create markets that sort of incentivize transition to sustainable economies, right? And I think really what we're kind of like beating around the bushes is that it's the system of capitalism that led us into this economic crisis to begin with. It's the sort of designation of certain populations in certain territories as disposable that has led us into our current epoch of global climate change. And so when we talk about who's going to bear the most burden when we transition, you know, out of the carbon economy, it most likely is going to be those populations that have historically been colonized, you know, and, you know, what's happening in Southeast Africa is a perfect example of why we need to transition away from not just the carbon economy, but capitalist economies in general. Because if we look at the history of how Africa has been a resource colony for Europe and for North America, we can look internally in the United States and understand that indigenous nations continue to serve as resource colonies for the United States, whether it's the Navajo Nation, where I'm living right now, that is producing oil and coal to generate electricity for the Southwest region, or whether it's the Fort Berthold Reservation up in North Dakota, that is, you know, the ground zero for oil and gas development in the Bakken region. We have to understand that indigenous nations have largely been turned into resource colonies and sites of sacrifice for not just the United States, but for the oil and gas industry. And so we need to not just think beyond climate change and putting carbon into the atmosphere, but we actually need to think about the system, the social system, right, that created those conditions in the first place. And so capitalism is fundamentally a social relation. It's a profit-driven system, whereas indigenous sort of ways of relating is one about reciprocity and mutual sort of respect, not just with the human, but also with the non-human world. And we're undergoing, you know, the sixth massive extinction event, which is caused by not just climate change, but is caused by capitalist sort of systems and the profit-driven sort of motive of our current economic and social system.
Nick Estes, you focus on seven historical moments of resistance in your new book, Our History is the Future. You say they form a historical roadmap for collective liberation. How did you choose these histories? Just quickly take us through them.
Sure. So I begin at the camps. I begin in the present, you know, at Standing Rock, and then I go to the fur trade with the first U.S. invasion, which was Lewis and Clark, who came through, who trespassed through our territory and were stopped by our leadership. And then I go through the Indian Wars of the 19th century and the Buffalo Genocide, and then I go into talking about the damming of the Missouri River in the mid 20th century, and then looking at red power in the 1960s and the 1970s, and how all of these indigenous people who were relocated because their lands were flooded by these dams eventually found themselves and created sort of the modern indigenous movement known as Red Power, and then going back and ending actually at Standing Rock in 1974 with the creation of the International Indian Treaty Council, which really coalesced these generations of indigenous resistance and took the treaties, the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, to the world and to the United Nations. And to do that, they looked to Palestinians. They looked to the South African anti-apartheid movement, who provided the mechanisms for recognition of indigenous rights at the United Nations. And that all resulted over four decades in the touchstone document, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was passed by the UN in 2007. And so in many ways, when we look at Standing Rock and we go down Flag Row and we see the hundreds of tribal nation flags that were represented in 2016 and 2017, we also saw the Palestinian flag that was there, kind of hearkening back to that international solidarity with movements of the global south, and specifically our Palestinian relatives, who today are still facing, much like us, are still facing the brunt and the brutality of settler colonialism, whether it's the United States recognizing the annexation of the Golan Heights, or whether it's here in North America and the continued dispossession of indigenous territory and rights. We can see that settler colonialism in Israel or in Palestine is really an extension of settler colonialism in North America. And then I end, with back at the camps and looking at how these camps really provided, I actually look at a physical map that was handed out to water protectors who came to the camp. And on that map, there was, where to find food, where to find the clinics, right? And where to find the security and all the camps that were represented at the at Standing Rock. And to me, that provided, a kind of interesting parallel to the world that surrounded the camps, which was 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions. You had the North Dakota National Guard, the world of cops, the world of the militarized sort of police state. And in the camps themselves, you had sort of the primordial sort of beginnings of what a world premised on indigenous justice might look like. And in that world, everyone got free food. There was a place for everyone. The housing, obviously was transient housing and teepees and things like that. But then also there was health clinics to provide healthcare, alternative forms of healthcare to everyone. And so if we look at that, it's housing, education, all for free, right? A strong sense of community. And for a short time, there was free education at the camps, right? Those are things that most poor communities in the United States don't have access to, and especially reservation communities. But given the opportunity to create a new world in that camp centered on indigenous justice and treaty rights, society organized itself according to need and not to profit. And so where there was, the world of settlers, settler colonialism that surrounded us, there was the world of indigenous justice that existed for a brief moment in time. And in that world, instead of doing to settler society what they did to us, genociding, removing, excluding, there's a capaciousness to indigenous resistance movements that welcomes in non-indigenous peoples into our struggle, because that's our primary strength, is one of relationality, one of making kin, right?
Nick, explain your title, Our History is the Future.
So that has two meanings. The first meaning is sort of a negative meaning, in the sense that the Ocheti Shakoi, the Great Sioux Nation, has undergone several apocalypses. Going back to the fur trade and the annihilation of fur-bearing animals in our region, going back to the annihilation of the buffalo to take the land and to starve us into surrender. Going back to the mid-20th century damming of the Missouri River, and now the North American sort of oil boom, these are different rounds of dispossession that, we see in a long continuum, right? And while history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, there's echoes that the United States has bailed itself out largely at the expense of indigenous peoples and indigenous lands. And so in many ways, what we're trying to prevent is that history in the future. But the other more sort of positive and generative aspect of that is our history is the future, in the sense that we have a long tradition of resistance to these sort of U.S.-imposed climate catastrophes on our own community, and we draw from, you know, the resistance movements going back to the first time we halted the trespass of Lewis and Clark through our territories and said, no, we are a sovereign nation. We have protection. We are the protectors of the Missouri River. Going back to the 19th century Indian Wars, and then, you know, my grandparents were water protectors in their own right because they fought for and tried to defend the Missouri River by preventing the construction of the Pixelone Dams in the 1950s and the 1960s. And so in many ways, I am just a product of my ancestors' resistance. They were water protectors before, and we have a new generation of water protectors now.
Nick Estes, Indigenous scholar and activist, speaking in 2019. His books include Our History is the Future. He's co-founder of the Indigenous resistance group, the Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. When we come back, we speak with the prize-winning author and journalist, Ta-Nehisi Coates. He has a new book out. It's called The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank and Israel.
Changing tide, river rise, the waters high.
DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday special, we spend the rest of the hour with the acclaimed writer and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message, which is based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank in Israel. Coates compares Israel's apartheid system to that of Jim Crow here in the United States. He writes, "It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet under American patronage that resembled the world that my parents were born into," unquote. In his book, Coates also writes about traveling to Senegal, where he visited the slave trade memorial at Gori Island, and going to South Carolina, where school officials tried to ban his book, Between the World and Me, which won the National Book Award in 2015. His current book, The Message, is written as a letter to his students at Howard University, where Ta-Nehisi Coates is the Sterling Brown Endowed Chair in the English Department. The Message is Coates' first collection of nonfiction since his 2017 book, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to Ta-Nehisi Coates in October. I began by asking him about where the book begins, Senegal. I asked him to talk about a journey he took there with great trepidation.
As you said, you know, we'll spend a lot of time talking about the occupied territories in Israel and the West Bank, but it's good to start here because the two parts are kind of paired to each other. African Americans are a group of people who have lived under the weight of artifice, a creation, a kind of mythology of what Africa is in our minds. If all of the myths of racism, all the justifications for enslavement, all the justifications for Jim Crow, at the end of the day, they have their origins in these constructions of Africa as this savage place, the idea that, you know, having been brought here, we're better off. Very, very typical of, you know, colonizing and conquering movements. And one of the things we've done to push back is create our own narratives, our own journeys, our own ideas of what Africa is. My very name comes out of that, which I'm very uncomfortable with, as I talk about in the book. And
talk about it.
Oh, boy. Oh, Lord. I wrote it. I should be very comfortable talking about it. You know, I was born in 1975. And that was a period in time coming out of Black Power, coming out of, you know, Black is Beautiful, like really discovering this idea that our sense of beauty, our nose, our lips, our names, our hair, that we had the right to take control over that, including our history. And so my name is an ancient Egyptian name that refers to the ancient kingdom of Nubia. The notion was that, put very, very crudely, that if the West had its kings and queens, if it had its great monuments, if it had its great ideas, so did we. And part of growing older, part of, you know, and I actually talk about this in Between the World and Me, part of becoming a writer, actually, is like our job is to be skeptical of clean stories. And I learned that very, very early on. And the message is kind of a continuation of that. Of course, the ultimate, I would say, I guess, climax in that journey is going to see the continent itself. And moving past myth, moving past the idea of constructed narratives, even when they're liberatory, even when they're emancipationist, to see the people themselves. And that is what took me to Dakar. And that is what I think took so long for me to go to Dakar.
And in terms of what most surprised you in the trip, could you talk about that?
Yeah, which most surprised me is the thing that will not surprise any African-American watching this interview. It was my deep sorrow. It was my deep, deep, deep sorrow. And I think, like, much of what I've, you know, just said in answer to Amy's question, I'd already intellectualized before I went. And so I was already thinking about this, but thinking about something and being confronted with it is a totally, totally different thing. It's a great Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they got punched. And as soon as that plane started descending out of the clouds over Dakar and I saw the buildings rising up, I was being punched. It is one thing to think about the Middle Passage, to think about your ancestors theoretically. It is quite another to literally sit on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean and look out and understand that this was, even if only symbolically, last stop.
And when you went to Gore, you decided that you did not want to have any of the tour guides.
No.
You wanted to wander around on your own.
No, but
talk about that experience.
By then, it was like day three. And so I understood that as much as I thought I was going to see the continent, I was actually going to see some sort of departed version of myself, you know, from hundreds of years ago. I was walking with ghosts the whole time, and I didn't want to be talked to. My family is from the eastern shore of Maryland, not too far from Ocean City, for anybody who knows that geography. It's like right on the Atlantic Ocean. And so to get back to Senegal, to get to Dakar, which is itself right on the tip of the continent, you know, I would look out and I would have these moments and I would say, my God, you know what I mean? There's part of me all the way on the other side and there's part of me that's here. And so, again, Gore is a place that has a lot of story and a lot of myth around it. And I read about that. I thought I was fully prepared. But I'm going to tell you, brother, you get on that boat and that boat pulls off and you think about all of your ancestors. And it was 7 a.m. in the morning and I was alone on that boat. And it is a very, very different experience.
And back to your name, Ta-Nehisi,
yes.
And also which goes to your parents as well,
yes.
And how their influence on you. Your dad, a former Black Panther, ran a publishing publishing press right in your house.
Yeah. No, and I think, like, what they were really trying to do, and this actually goes to the core of what the book is about. How do you tell your own story? How do you free yourself from a history, from novels, from film, from television, an entire architecture that is designed to tell you that you are exactly where you belong because of who you are, because of what you are, either because of your genes, because God said, you know, you belong there. How do you construct something different? And one of the things I'm trying to confront in the book is, I think perhaps step one is almost to make a mirror image of the people that have put you in that situation. Well, you say with this, we're actually that. But I think one of the most difficult things is to free yourself entirely of that structure and to construct your own morality, your own stories, your own ideas that don't necessarily depend on those who have put you in the situation to begin with.
And the structure of your book is addressed to your students at Howard. The decision to choose that form for your book?
You know, I was, to be honest with you, I've not said this anywhere. I was very worried about that because I'd done that. Like, I'd written this letter in Between the World and Me, and I thought people could get, oh, my God, he's going to do this again. What, Between the World and Me again? But the fact of the matter is I am always trying to achieve intimacy with the reader. That's the, you know, the primary job. I would tell my students all the time, look, you are dealing with readers who could be doing anything else. They could be on their smartphones. They could be playing video games. They could be watching movies. They could be watching TV. They could be somewhere making love. They could be doing anything but reading you. And so you have a responsibility to make them feel a sense of intimacy and immediacy. And I was lucky in the sense that, you know, these were very, very real conversations that I'd had with my students, so I had something to pull from, you know. And also, you know, the fact of just the letter form allowed me to do that. It allows me to get, you know, a kind of intimacy with my reader.
Talk about George Orwell, Why I Write, and connecting politics and language in the promise you made to your students at Howard. Your Between the World and Me was written to your son, Samari, this to the students.
Yeah. So we usually start actually with politics in the English language. That's the first essay that I have them read, you know, just to think about language as a political thing. You know, we live in this world where I feel that oftentimes we are taught, not that everybody subscribes to this, that art lives over here and politics lives over here. And that politics itself is actually very, very limited. That, you know, it happens every 2 or 4 years. It's in the voting booth. It's who you decide, you know, to vote for. It's what issues you decide to activate on. But one of the arguments that I make in the message is that there's an entire architecture outside of the world of mean politics that determines how politicians actually talk, the choices they give, you know, et cetera. Why does Kamala Harris feel the need, for instance, to say that she has a gun? What is that actually based on? And I would say it is based on archetypes of femininity. I would say it's built based on archetypes of race, archetypes of the cowboy. And where do those archetypes come from? They come from our art. They come from our literature. They come from our film, our TVs, our commercials. You know, and at their base, they ultimately come from writing because somebody has to write those ultimately. And in that world, things that seem separated from politics never really are. And so I wanted to start this book, The Message, with that Orwell quote, because that's like one of the things he kind of is obsessing with in that essay. And at the same time, there's this beautiful tension that I often feel, which is in a different world, you know, he would just write beautiful stories. He would just play with language for the hell of playing with language. But he doesn't live in that world. And I don't feel that my students live in that world. They live in a world of, as we'll talk about, genocide, apartheid, segregation, global warming, you know, Category 5 hurricanes, you know, flood on one coast, fire on the other. These are immediate issues. And I don't believe that they as writers, we as writers, have the luxury of sort of sitting back in our salons and in our living rooms, you know, simply constructing beautiful language for the hell of constructing beautiful language. It has to be engaged with something.
From Saigon, you take us to Columbia, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Why that choice?
Well, I was writing this in a time where this wave of book bannings was happening. And I always wanted to write about that. But I felt that I was worried about making the writer the center of the book banning. Because even though the work is directed at the writer, the writer is actually not the person that suffers under the book ban. The teachers suffer under the book ban. It's the teachers who are under threat for losing their job. It's the teachers who get harassed. It's the librarians who are under threat of losing their jobs. It's the librarians who get harassed. It's the students who lose the ability to have access to different worlds and different ways of thinking. And I was trying to figure out how I could write this in such a way so that I would not be the center of it. Luckily, you know, I ended up in conversation with a teacher by the name of Mary Wood from Chapin, South Carolina, went to Chapin High School where she teaches and where she was trying to teach Between the World and Me and got into some amount of trouble for that. And she invited me down, you know, just to, you know, go to a hearing. And that's what I did. And it was quite eventful. It was not the world that I expected. It was not the audience I expected. It was interesting to see how much support actually was rallied behind her, even though she's in a deep red area, in a deep red state. And so that, too, is about the power of stories. That, too, is about the power of narratives, the questions we ask and the questions we don't.
You write in the message about this experience in South Carolina. I see politicians in Colorado and Tennessee and South Carolina moving against my own work, tossing books I've authored out of libraries, banning them from classes. I feel snatched out of the present and dropped into an age of pitchforks and book-burning bonfires. My first instinct is to laugh, but then I remember that American history is filled with men and women who were as lethal as they were ridiculous. Now, if
you got one running for president right now, you know, lethal and ridiculous.
Well, you talk about the